Should be scared. No, not at all. You have a great story to tell, so we're just trying to get it. Are you ready? So can you tell me where you were born?
I was born in a little town in Texas called Joaquin, Texas, and that's spelled Joaquin. It's in East Texas near the Louisiana border. Population 500 at the time. It's probably smaller than that now.
500, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. In your neighborhood in Joaquin, am I saying it right?
Yes.
Were there any whites?
Well, it's interesting you would ask that. There were no whites on our street, but our property abutted the main street, one of the main streets going into town. And there were whites all along that street. And we were separated by, at one time there was a fence there, but at various places the fence no longer stood, so you could just walk back and forth, and we did. There were white children on the other side of that fence that we played with.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm trying to envision the street, because our streets there, like they are here, you say, like...
The street that ran in front of my house was in the black community.
Mm-hmm.
There was a parallel street, but, you know, the property, we had a lot of property. So if you just kept walking, went out my back door and just kept walking, not toward the main street in front of our house, but in the opposite direction, you would run into the other neighborhood.
Wow, that had to be a really, like, interesting place to live, a different dynamic.
Oh, it was, very much so, because it was during what they call Jim Crow, the Jim Crow period. So that was the strict segregation of schools, segregation of public accommodations, but churches, you name it, it was segregated. However, these little kids we played with, kids played together, and in fact, on occasion, they would come over. And we would walk up the street in the black community and walk to the movie theaters together. And we would go upstairs, they would go downstairs, and then we'd meet after the movie and walk home together. Don't ask.
Okay.
But that's the way it was. It was kids just, I mean, we understood the system, that we couldn't go in there together. But it didn't mean that we couldn't play together.
But did you understand why?
Never did. I really don't to this day, to tell the truth.
Did your parents explain it to you? How did you know about this system?
Well, as you grew up, when I was just probably 3 or 4, I vaguely remember going into the drugstore with my mother and my big brother, who was just 15 months older. And we walked in the drugstore, and as we were going past the soda fountain, where there were stools where you could sit and order shakes or hot dogs or whatever, I tried to climb up on one of the stools. And my brother, who was, as I say, just a little bit older, knew that I wasn't supposed to be there, and he pulled me down from the stool. And so somehow we were told from time to time, you can't go there, you can't go there, you can't go there, but never any reasons why.
Did your parents have any concerns about you being a woman?
Well, back in those days, in a lot of ways, it was more the guys had more of a threat. And my parents always encouraged, I had one brother and two sisters, and they encouraged all of us to get an education. They were both teachers. They were both educated. And in fact, my mother's parents were college graduates. But education was always big for us, and they always emphasized that you could do anything you wanted to do, even though all around us we could see we couldn't.
Right.
The only thing about being a woman that kind of came through, my father would never let us babysit for white families or do any kind of work for white families, because sometimes they would ask, you know, when you were teenagers, could you do maid work? Or we were never allowed to work for white families.
Did he ever tell you why?
Nope.
Did you ever wonder?
I wondered, but my parents were strict anyway. Like overnights, we were never allowed to do overnights with friends. And I remember even in high school, everything was segregated. You couldn't go to a hotel. You could not. And so I was an officer in the student council, and they had a student council meeting, a national meeting, a state meeting in San Antonio, Texas. And I was so excited because I thought I was going to get to go to the state meeting. But the kids were staying in private homes because hotels were not available to black students. And my father said, no, you will not be going because I don't know anyone in San Antonio. So if we had family, if we had friends that they had confidence in, then we could go and stay. But so when he said, I was used to no.
So can you tell me a little bit about your family dynamic and how you explained that both of your parents were educated and
yes.
Your grandparents, that's really amazing. Wow. Your grandparents were educated, but the family dynamic, them being strict, did you have a gun in your foot? Dr. Yo, somebody has to ask this. So if she, you know.
That's
so if you,
fine.
You don't want to answer
anything.
Okay. Did you have a gun in your house?
Yes. My daddy had a shotgun.
Did he ever have to use it?
No. And not while we were around anyway. He wasn't big on hunting, but I do recall an incident that I learned about when I was grown. I didn't know about this growing up. But apparently, when my father was a young man, there was an incident involving an uncle of his who had gotten into some trouble that was never, ever spelled out to me. But they stayed up all night with guns, fearing attacks by whites in the community because of this alleged crime that he had committed. And the uncle left Texas never to return. Maybe he visited later on, I don't know. But he moved, and that was never discussed when I was a child.
Did you see any of that kind of stuff?
Never.
Like,
the only thing that I saw was the discrimination, you know, having to go to the back door if you wanted to be served at a fast food restaurant, or not being able to go in at all to most restaurants, or being turned away. I remember on our honeymoon, my husband and I drove from Texas, East Texas, to Chicago, where he was in graduate school, and we stopped for gas only because there was nowhere we could spend the night.
When was this?
1964.
But you had just finished fighting when you were
just
expelled.
Finished fighting, and it was still, well, remember Brown versus Board of Education was in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
And when I graduated school in 1959, Oh, goodness. Maybe it was earlier than that.
Brown?
Yes.
It's 54.
54, that's right. And in 59, when I graduated from a segregated high school.
Okay.
So there was all deliberate speed, not only in the educational system, but also in public accommodations. That didn't come until later. Now, in Atlanta, because of the marches of the students, because of the jails, the students being jailed and the protests, then they opened up a few places, but still you could not go into a hotel.
So can you, you graduated from a segregated school?
Yes, in high segregated
high school.
School.
And
yes.
Then you came to Spumer.
Yes.
How did that happen? How did you make that choice to change the world and come to Spumer?
Well, I was interested in leaving home. And I met this woman who taught at Jarvis Christian College, which was about 15 miles from my home in Gladewater, Texas, because we moved from Joaquin to Gladewater when I was 10 years old. And when I was in high school, I was looking at different colleges, and my preference was to go away from home, but I didn't really know about any schools outside of Texas. And I met this woman who taught at Jarvis, and she was a Spelman graduate. And she had her yearbooks, and she told me about Spelman, and it just sounded idyllic. So I applied to Spelman, and I got a scholarship, and I was so excited, and I just prayed my parents would let me go. And they did.
Did you have family? Did your father know anybody?
No family. But he talked around, and he was convinced that Spelman was a safe environment for me. Little did he know the trouble I was to get into.
Now, for your moves and all that kind of stuff, was it safe to go around at night in Texas? I mean, I keep going back to Texas. We can. I just wanted to get this one question
okay.
out.
Well, in the little town where I was born, I left when I was 10 years old, so I wasn't doing much walking the streets except to go to the movies, and that was during the daytime to the matinees. But it was a fearful time in that you were never really safe. There were no, in the words of Plessy V. Ferguson, you had no rights that whites were bound to respect. And so I recall an incident which I believe prompted the move from Joaquin to Gladewater. My father was a minister and a principal of the school, and my mother taught there at the school. So one night we were at church, and it was the middle of the week, you know, like a Wednesday night prayer service or something. In the middle of service, the sheriff and several of his men came storming into our church. They found whoever they were looking for was a man, and they picked him up and pistol whipped him out of the church and took him to jail. Nothing was ever done. There were rumors that people would be found floating in the Sabine River, black people. Nothing was ever done. So it was, you sort of feared, you just knew that you couldn't go to court and complain about any treatment. And much of the time, the violence was perpetrated by the police.
And you were okay with going to Spelman alone with all of this going on?
Well, it was okay. When we left Joaquin and moved to Gladewater, it was a different atmosphere. It was, even though it was segregated, we had segregated schools, but there wasn't the lawlessness being committed by the police. And in the larger cities, for the most part, if you kept your nose clean, if you didn't violate any laws, you were not abused just routinely. So I was probably as safe, got on the train, segregated train, rode all the way to Atlanta, Georgia, and never had a problem. I had one incident, and that was on a bus when the train broke down in some town, and they put us on buses for the rest of the way. And I didn't go far enough to the back of the bus that the bus driver thought I should have gone. So they had a rest stop, and when I got back on, he said, "See if you can't sit further back." I said, "Yes, sir." I was by myself, and I wasn't starting anything.
How did it feel walking back there?
It didn't feel good. Did not feel good. But I don't know, it was in some little town in Alabama, and I wasn't going to, nobody would even know I was there, because see, I was supposed to be on the train. And y'all never would have heard from me. That man put me off that bus.
So can you tell me a little bit about Jim Crow in Atlanta?
Jim Crow in Atlanta.
In
1959. When I got to Atlanta, I went to the train station, and it was completely segregated. You had a white waiting room and a colored waiting room. And you had the white drinking fountains and the colored drinking fountain. And never the twain should meet. When we got there, but I was used to that. I grew up under that, so I didn't expect, you know, commingling of the races. But when you got on campus, it was this protected atmosphere, and you were among your peers, and all you had to worry about, at least for the first semester, was getting your lesson and, you know, getting to meet new people, and it was an exciting time. We were allowed to go to leave the campus freshmen in groups of six, and we would go downtown and shop, but you could not sit down in the restaurants. Like at Rich's, you could go and spend your money on all floors except the Magnolia Room was the dining room at Rich's, and you were not allowed to go into the Magnolia Room. That was Jim Crow. But this is Jim Crow, not by custom, but by custom and law. You could be arrested for going into the Magnolia Room. And in the hotels, you were not allowed to spend the night at all. If you were going there, you were going to work as a maid or a janitor. The bus, you about rode in the back of the bus. That's what Jim Crow was like.
1959. Jim Crow in Atlanta.
Yep.
And you said first semester was calm.
First semester was calm. Second semester is when the Greensboro students sat in. Mm-hmm. And when they sat in, the Atlanta students started talking, and they said, they'd already been talking, but they hadn't decided, you know, exactly when and where to strike. And so after Greensboro beat us to the punch, so to speak, then Lonnie King, who was chair, he went to Yates and Milton, which was a drugstore on the corner where now the Henderson student center is at Clark Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And it was a drugstore there, and you know, a lot of the students would hang out there on the corner. And so he knew Julian. They were both at Morehouse. And in fact, that story was just told again this morning at the dedication, where they renamed Fair Street for the Atlanta Student Movement. And it's the Atlanta Student Movement Boulevard. So anyway, Lonnie was telling, actually Julian told the story, how Lonnie had a newspaper, and he said, "Did you see this?" And it was a story of the Greensboro sit-ins. And anyway, he convinced Julian and other students from the AU Center to get started with the Atlanta Student Movement. And the first act was to publish an appeal for human rights, setting forth the problems in our society caused by segregation and the fact that we could not sit idly by anymore and be denied our human rights. And it was announcing the beginning of the marches and sit-ins to protest segregation in Atlanta.
How early did you get involved?
This was, by this time, it was March of 1960. And in March of 1960, it began with, as I said, I was a freshman. It was the second semester of my freshman year. I was 16 when I came to Spelman. And as I indicated, I had led a pretty sheltered life except for those notable violent episodes. So my parents, of course, were adamant that I not get involved because they taught school and school teachers were losing their jobs when their students, their children who were protesting were arrested. They would lose their jobs. So the first time, it was just mass meetings on each campus. The presidents of the student government associations at the different AU Center schools comprised the committee on the appeal for human rights. They wrote the appeal, they raised money to publish the appeal, and they scheduled mass meetings. We met at Giles Hall for most of the meetings.
It's my hall.
Is that your hall?
I'm a political science major.
Wow.
So I spent a lot of time in there.
Yeah, well, it was in Giles Hall that we met. And I sat there and I heard them talk about, now the leaders had been meeting. And they initially only wanted a group to train to sit in. They didn't want everybody going down the first time. They wanted a cadre of well-trained, well-disciplined students who would withstand the temptation to strike back. We were following Dr. King's nonviolent method of protest. And so they all but hand-picked the first group of students who would actually do the sit-ins. So I was not in that group. Then they opened it up for mass marches. And so even though I knew my parents didn't want me participating, I thought, there's safety in numbers. They're back in Texas, they'll never find out. At the time, I wasn't thinking about getting arrested. So anyway, they had, you know, the Atlanta University quadrangle, which is now Clark Atlanta, is Trevor Arnett, the art gallery, that big quadrangle there, that's where many of the mass meetings were held for all of the AU Center students. We also had one at Morris Brown at the stadium. But and we marched downtown and marched around Riches and marched a number of places protesting segregation. We had picket signs, and after there was no violence the first time I marched, then it became a lot easier. I felt like they weren't going to turn the dogs on us or the water hoses or shoot us or throw bricks or anything. So it got a little easier each time we went to march.
Did they ever throw bricks at you? Or?
Never bricks, but soon the police got tired of it and started arresting students en masse. I never got arrested. I came close one time, and that was at when we picketed Grady Hospital. But I wasn't in that first group, because there were thousands of students, it seemed. And the first group, we heard the paddy wagons coming. We hadn't been out there too long, maybe 30 minutes, maybe an hour. And all of a sudden, I hear the siren. I thought, oh, this is it. And they started just hauling off students en masse, and they filled up all the paddy wagons just before they got to my group. And I said, thank you, Lord.
So can you take me to a demonstration?
Okay.
One of the marches.
Well, I'll take you to the Riches marches. You know, it's so funny now. When I marched from Northside Drive to this morning, from Northside Drive to James P. Brawley at the corner of the old Fair Street and James P. Brawley, that seemed like a long walk. But at that time, we would walk from the then Atlanta University quadrangle to Martin Luther King, which is now Martin Luther King. It was then Hunter Street. Turn right and march all the way downtown. And do you know where the old Riches is? It's now the federal building. We would march there and then just march around Riches, seems like for days. And then walk home, walk back to the campus. And when we marched at Grady, Grady is several blocks from there, maybe six or seven blocks from the old Riches. And we marched the whole time, and sometimes with heels on. We were dressed up, Spelman, well, not just Spelman, the other students too, the girls from the other colleges. We dressed up to go picket. I also helped to make signs at Rush Memorial Church. We would make signs, picket signs, and flyers to announce different protests. So it was not just being part of the march, it was being involved in helping to get the students out to participate and to show up in mass. But it was exciting. It was fearful at first, but like I said, after you'd done it a few times and nobody came after you, then it wasn't as much fear involved for me. And it was fearful again when you hear the police sirens. That was fearful. But one day when we marched at A&P, I looked on the other side of the street, and Dr. King was standing there encouraging us. And that just felt so good, because we had a lot of respect for him.
What kind of fear was it? Was it the same type of fear you felt walking around in Texas or being in Texas? Or can you explain?
No, this was a little more immediate fear. because you were confronting the establishment. There were people, I tried to keep my eyes focused straight ahead. I didn't look across the street at whites who were shouting. I just concentrated on carrying my picket sign and marching around wherever we were marching. And but the fear was that any minute you could come under attack, or any minute you could be arrested. That was an immediate fear, rather than a generalized kind of I don't have any rights and somebody might come and get me. But no, this was because we knew what had happened in other cities in the South. And we knew that there was not support from the governor in Georgia, that there was not support from the white establishment in Atlanta, that the citizens were irate. So you just never knew when members of the Klan or anybody else could just fire off into the crowd.
Did you or any of your friends come into close connection or?
Those students who participated in the first sit-ins were, when I say attacked, there were instances where they were, cigarette burns, they were trying to be evicted from places and yelled at, and so there was not the kind of violence that occurred in Birmingham, what they used to call Bombingham, or even Montgomery, but it was not pleasant. Things were thrown on them like drinks or food, so it was a scary time, a frightening time. But no one was seriously hurt.
What was different?
Actually, I take that back. Someone threw acid on Lonnie King. So there were instances where violence reared its ugly head. So you knew not to be too comfortable.
And I know this is going to sound like a really bizarre question, but why would you get involved when it, with all that fear and coming from where you come from?
Yeah.
And you know there's safety in education.
So. Well, but as safe as it was, they called my father and my mother, little white kids would call them by their first names. As safe as it was in my household, if you left my household and you went downtown, you were never sure if you would be treated fairly. And certainly if some rank stranger could beat you, and you had no recourse. So it was almost, there was this little park not far from my home, and I remember always wanting to go to that park, and I was always told no. And I would see little white kids playing in that park. And after this incident happened in my church, you're not even safe in your church. So after years and years and years of this kind of treatment, and somebody comes along and says, we're tired and we're not going to take it anymore, you just know it's time for you to take a stand. And maybe, even if you get hurt, maybe it will open the doors for another generation. I was never sure we were going to be successful. And it took time, even, after that, for the doors to open completely. But no, you could stay cocooned in the black community and be safe in your educated family for just so long, but you gotta leave there sometime. And it wasn't just for us. It was for others in the black community who weren't so fortunate to have an education, they were harassed daily because they had to work for the man. So there was no, it was like the dam had broke and all these pent-up feelings about the absolute wrongness of that system, that you just felt that I've got to be involved.
That's a lot. Wow. How, when you eventually tell your parents?
I never discussed it with my father. I told my mother. But I was afraid if I told my father, he would tell me to come home. That was really the reason I was afraid to get involved initially, and that, you know, to volunteer for that first group was because I didn't want them losing their jobs, and I really didn't want to go home. And if they lost their jobs, not only would I go home, but I had a brother who was in college, and my sister the next year went to college, and we were still protesting then. And so it was not just me that I was would be impacting by my involvement. So I had to think long and hard before getting out there, but in the end it was just, there was no other, you know, course to take.
How did the Spelman administration, did they agree with it?
No, but you know, I have come over the years to understand why they took a stand against it. Because the administration, they not only felt responsible for us, they felt responsible for making sure that the schools survived.
I'm sorry, I was freaking out. Trying to make sure I was getting it off.
You know, that Spelman and the other schools, they depend on contributions for their survival. These are private schools. And so they couldn't be outwardly supporting us, but as far as I know, no one got expelled. So even though they said, do not participate, they sent letters home to our parents saying we were participating. They did not outwardly support the movement. But I really think it was to protect us and to protect them and the school from liability and from extinction.
Oh, we love that beautiful school.
Yes.
I'm sorry. What was your most defining moment in the movement?
You know, it's funny. That day when the paddy wagons filled up and left without me, I initially was just, thank you, Jesus. But so many students got locked up that day. And they stayed in jail for a week, some almost a week before they were released. And part of that sacrifice that they made, and many of my friends were included in that, in jail, part of their sacrifice, I believe, resulted in the agreement to end segregation at Rich's and some of the other downtown establishments. And so it was like a red badge of courage to have been in that group, in the jailbird group. And I missed out on that. I was there to welcome them home, but I always felt that, you know, I picketed with them and I was just involved, except I didn't go to jail. And so, although I did everything I could do to support that movement except go to jail, I always felt like I missed out.
What was it like welcoming them back?
Oh, goodness. It was relief, joy, just exhilaration. And to have it be a part of a solution, even though a small one. Everything wasn't, you know, the doors didn't completely open. And ironically, those that did open, we were not really in a position to take full advantage of it. I didn't have the money to go to the Magnolia Room and be but it was a great celebration, not just for the students, but also for the Atlanta black community who had supported the students. Not everybody did. Many of them thought we were stirring up trouble, we were going to make it worse for everyone. But there were those who really went out of their way to support us and to get the students out of jail, to provide transportation, to provide food, to provide moral support. We had a boycott of Riches and some of the other stores too. But with respect to Riches, the student leaders said, don't shop at Riches and send us your Riches credit cards to show support. Do you know they did? Many of them did. And so when the students were locked up, it was like the whole community was locked up. So when they were freed, it was quite a celebration.
How did your community look? I don't know if you guys could live off campus at Sawmill, or how did that time,
if you were a city student, I don't know if they call them that now, but at the time, if you lived in Atlanta or the Atlanta metro area, you could live at home except for your freshman year. You had to live on campus. Later it was 1 year you had to live on campus. It didn't have to be your freshman year, but started out, you had to spend your first year on campus. So there were many students who lived in the city. I've forgotten your question.
I was trying to figure out if there were any whites involved in when you guys were, we have a lot of different schools around here.
Right. Well, there were a few. Not a whole lot, but there were some from Emory. And I believe Agnes Scott had a few. But most of the white students, Tech, Georgia State was just, I'm not even sure, it was just beginning. So we didn't have a lot of students there. And they were not on campus. They didn't have any dorms at that time.
Mm-hmm. I'm like in awe right now, just because I'm looking at what we do, or what we don't do, and what we take for granted. But you guys just celebrated your 50th anniversary this year? How was that?
That was amazing. We had several activities. The Atlanta History Center opened with an exhibit. We had all of the AU Center schools hosted events. And Dr. Marion Wright Edelman spoke over at Spelman. And there was a forum at Morehouse, and Lonnie King spoke. We had events at Clark Atlanta, and it was, and ITC hosted all of our planning meetings, so, and we also had participation by the students. The students had a forum discussing the research that they had done from the movement, and they interviewed us. The AU Center Library, the Woodruff Library, had an oral history project, and students who were former students who came in for the 50th anniversary were interviewed, and we just had a grand time. Pascal's, which at the old Pascal's restaurant had been just a gathering place for the movement, and had a big dinner in celebration when the students were released from jail. It's closed now, but the new Pascal's on Northside Drive held a dinner, I guess an anniversary dinner, in support of the students. So we just had a grand time. It was more, it was not just celebration, but a discussion forum on where do we go from here, and how can we get the current students involved to make a difference in their communities.
What did you guys come up with? What do you want us to do?
Well, the first thing is really to know your history, to learn about what happened at the AU Center 50 years ago, and how just ordinary students, but you know, I say ordinary, but they were really extraordinary. Very bright, very committed, fearless, tenacious. But so are today's students. So you have that ability. And if we can get you to focus not just on what's good for me and what's going to help me make it, but also focus on the larger community. What are the ills in our society that need to be addressed, and how can I make a difference? And that doesn't have to be by marching downtown. But we didn't have that many students to even come out this morning for the dedication. But I hope that when they see that sign, Atlanta Student Movement Boulevard, the street sign, that they will be inspired enough to wonder, why was that street changed? And who were these people? And how can I make a difference?
Do you think that you guys achieved all the goals that you set for?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But we put a chink in that wall of segregation, and it slowly began to crumble. And from that movement, students went out all over the United States and sometimes all over the world. And once you've been an activist like that, you can, we really should do a where are they now kind of study, because these students made a difference in their communities wherever they went. And they still are, even in our 60s and 70s. They're still working to make this a better place.
But in 1964, when you got married and going on your honeymoon and still driving, how did that feel, you know, not being able to stop? You had just fought. You had just risked your life every day for that. How did that feel?
It felt like we still have work to do, and it still feels like that. We still have work to do. When I hear some of these campaign ads and some of the rhetoric at the marches of the Tea Party, they want to turn the clock back. And we cannot let that happen. And if you don't know your past, you are bound to repeat it.
So is this how it was? Was the rhetoric?
Oh, it was worse. Much, much worse. I remember sitting watching my TV, and it was during a political campaign, and this person who was running for office said, "We love our Negroes in their place." Free speech. We'll get there again. We're almost there now. Now they're saying, take our country back. Back from what?
How do you fight that kind of segregation since it's not a law? So back then you guys were fighting the law.
We were fighting the law. But there are people today of all races who understand the truth that we're all really one race, and that's the human race. And they will fight for human rights, and we need to just reach out. It's not just us. It wasn't even then. There were people even then who were quietly supporting us, who were not black. And so we have to reach out to people of goodwill of all races and religions and not let them turn the clock back. If you go along thinking, oh, well, you know, that's not going to happen, or you don't know how bad it was, and so you're operating out of ignorance, then it can just slip back. And I see people with, black people with the Tea Party movement, and they don't understand. They do not understand. So we just have to find the people who do understand and work to educate our young people and work to educate the others who are willing to listen.
Are you really fearful?
I'm not fearful, because I think we've come a long way, baby. Yes, we have a long way to go, and yes, there are those who want to turn the clock back, but there are more of us who want to move forward than want to turn it back, so it's not going to happen. It will, though, if our young people don't get involved and join with us and say, it's not going to happen.
If you could speak to my generation, what would you tell us about activism? What's the next step?
Well, I would say there's more than one way to achieve the goals. But first, you need to be talking about it and educating yourself about the different areas in our society that need work. Education, the criminal justice system. You just pick an issue, and then be involved in finding out about, you know, how this is negatively affecting our people. And how can we move forward? If all you want is a fast car and a big house, you can really miss the boat. You need to find an issue that you feel comfortable with and find out how you can make a difference. And maybe that's through mentoring a child. Maybe that's through running for office and being a politician that cares about the people and advancing the cause of the people. But whatever area you choose to go on, and it may be that you need to yet it hit the streets and march around a few buildings and make some noise. But it doesn't, there's no one way to make a difference. Get involved in politics. Vote. Vote. If they sit up in those dormitories after people have bled and died, gone to jail, suffered, and not vote, it would just break my heart. That would break my heart.
Thank you, Judge Cole.
You're welcome.
I appreciate you. You've given me a lot today, definitely. You've given me a challenge, to be completely honest. But it's doable.
It's absolutely doable.
Thank you. I definitely appreciate you.
I didn't put this on, but when I finished Spelman, there were no black judges in Atlanta. None. In 1964, Attorney A.T. Walter was appointed municipal court judge, and he was the first in the city. I had already graduated. And now we're all over the place.
Were you trying to make a stand when you became a judge here?
Absolutely not. The stand had already been made by people like Thelma White, Cummings Moore, and Judge Clarence Cooper, and Judge Horace Ward, and Isabel Gates Webster. I was just walking through a door that had been blown right wide open.
Thank you.
Thank you.